Oh, thank you, Jim. I wrote him a nice introduction. I like this guy. There are a few guys in here who actually are brands. Like, we have Luis Navidad. And we have Doug G. And we have tonight's speaker, Eric with a K.
Hello, everybody. I'm Eric with a K. I'm a grateful Al-Anon member. I want to thank John for, love you, man. I want to thank John for asking me to speak. I also want to let him know he made it on my fourth step. This is a big deal, you know. It's a scary thing to do, so. But I want to thank John for asking me to basically participate in my own recovery. And I'm glad to be here tonight, I guess, for that reason. So I'm going to try and talk in a general way about, you know, what it was like and what brought me into Al-Anon and what it's like today. I am one of those variety of Al-Anons that grew up around the effects of the disease of alcoholism. It was pretty much there from the day I was born. Let me quickly get out of the way a couple of other things, too. My home group is the 7 o'clock Let's Rock Thursday night men's group. And I want to, you know, there's some other meetings that I go to, and I notice some of the people there that are sort of part of my family as well. You know, I got the Friday night barefoot meeting in Burbank. Love you guys. And the Saturday 6 p.m. Burbank ACA-focused Al-Anon meeting. You guys are great. And there's this new little meeting that I've been going to in Paramount City. Not on the lot. That'd be fun, but... I'm sure lots of people qualify there. But anyway, it's a small meeting. It's started by my sponsor, and it kind of guarantees that I get some time at the mic at that meeting. But also time with my sponsor. That's been a really important part of my recovery process, and I'll get to more of that later. My earliest, start with my earliest childhood memory. I don't know if you've ever asked yourself this question, but what's the earliest thing that you can remember? And for me, the earliest memory I can recall is being about three, maybe three and a half, and getting all this attention from my brothers and sisters in the family for being able to lift a bunk bed off the floor. So to me, that just says, you know, okay, Al-Anon at three and a half, I'm already approval-seeking, so. And another interesting fact about, you know, me is the nickname that my family chose to give me at a very, very young age. Probably around the same time, actually. Actually earlier, because as the story goes, one of my favorite toys as a kid was to play with these wickered wine bottles that the Italians like to drink out of. And my mother kept them, and we would put candles in them and things. And those were sort of toys for me as a kid. And one day, I was just having me walk down the hallway, staggering along, with two of these, you know, wicker wine bottles, like, on each side. And my sister just screams out in a holler and says, "Look, it's a boozer!" And so from that day forward, you know, a boozer became booze. And... you know, the irony isn't lost on me in Al-Anon. My family liked to taunt me, too, you know. We liked to play practical jokes on each other. And so my brothers and sisters would take that name, Booze, and they would try to say it in the most possible annoying way. And what we discovered quickly is that you have to add a lot of vowels to make that work. And so booze became ba-ooze. Ba-ooze. Now that sounds annoying, doesn't it? Ba-ooze became ba-roos. You have to add an R in there. And then pretty soon they're like, ba-roos-oy. And I swear to God, if they would say that enough times, I would pull out one of my old Al-Anon tricks, which was to throw a huge tantrum to get my way. And, you know, I used to hate being called that. And one of the benefits of recovery today is I don't have any resentment around that anymore. In fact, I own a 1969 Mustang, and the license plate says Borussia on it. You know, I grew up in a home where the alcoholics weren't really present. It was the untreated Al-Anons that I was raised by. It was my dad's grandfather that drank, and his father before him that died of the disease. And there's just a lot of alcoholism up through my dad's line. And when I was asked, you know, recently, well, you know, okay, so Eric, do you have any siblings or anything that might drink or use in a way that might kind of bug you a little? And so I went through my siblings. It's a long list. I had 9 brothers and 4 sisters. And I think it was like 8 of them. 8 of them qualified for like drinking too much. It's a kind of a, it's just something our family does. One of the things about my dad and my mom's relationship was my dad was real obsessed with my mom. And he was real obsessed with work. He's more of an obsessive kind of a person, you know, like he's an amazing man too. He's an architect where he worked for the Canadian National Parks. It was a beautiful, beautiful kind of a job. And he had a lot of talents, but you know, when he came home, there just wasn't a lot of his talent to go around in that home. Because, you know, the relationship between my parents was pretty tenuous. My mom loved to kind of just focus everything on herself. And my dad loved to just focus everything on my mom. And that didn't leave a whole lot of time, you know, for raising kids and that sort of thing. So I kind of felt like I had to raise myself. It also meant that, you know, I was sort of just constantly afraid all the time. For a long time, I didn't know why. Until I realized that one of the parents' jobs is to essentially protect children from the other children in the home. and there were a few, you know. So I spent a lot of time just feeling really afraid, and just about what was going to come next. I kind of developed a real sort of paranoid style, trying to see the future before it happened. So I'd get out of the way. And, you know, another event that happened was, I just remember the first day I went to kindergarten. And my parents decided to send me to French immersion school. Yes, I grew up in Canada. And I don't think they have very many French immersions here, in case you're wondering. Anyway, they just had this little small bus that came through our neighborhood, which was predominantly English. And to pick up little kids that were going to go off to French immersion like me. And I just remember being out there on the front of the house at the age of 5. And I was alone. And I really just, that was an ice cold chill I felt. No, it wasn't the Canadian weather. No, that wasn't a joke either. Just seeing if you're awake. So being 5 and just being put out in the front of the house to go to school for the very first time without any sort of parental guidance was just kind of what happened in my family. That kind of thing just happened all the time. Later, you know, I was asked later that year to kind of help around the house a little bit. And I was eager to help. I don't even really know why, but I was really eager to help because when they asked me to do the dishes, and that was the biggest job in the house, it usually took between 1.5 to 3 hours every night. And, you know, when I was asked, it was just sort of like, yeah, really? Cool. I'll do that. And so my older sister, being real smart, helped me for about 2 weeks and then just sort of disappeared. And as a young kid, being given tons of responsibility, I didn't complain because, look, I can do it all by myself. That's me at 5.5. And I did that for about a year, and it just, it was untenable. Like, it's completely impossible. You know, I was going crazy because while I was doing the dishes, my brothers were in the other room watching all my favorite TV shows. So, and that might have been my first resentment right there. So, I just remember like our family, you know, they were doing their best, and my parents would have these things called family councils. It's just a gathering of us, where each person, our nickname for it was bitch sessions, because that's about all you did in these sessions. Each person got a turn to kind of just whine, and when it got to my turn. I just remember being so overwhelmed with those dishes and stuff, and I just blurted out. First the tears came, and then came the words, "Why do I always have to do the dishes on Sunday?" Sunday was the hardest day, and Sunday was like a veritable Thanksgiving every week. It was insane, and I cried, and I let them know that was bothering me. I let them know what I needed. I needed a relief. And my mother's reaction was to simply say, "Next." And it just, something happened inside of me that changed me. In that moment, it changed me. And I had developed a couple of attitudes that, you know, stayed with me for several decades. And one of them was, okay, looks like, Eric, no one gives a rat's poop about how you feel. So there's no point in feeling, let alone telling people how you feel. So let's just bottle that stuff and put it away. It's useless. Second thing I decided was, and they're never going to hear me ask for anything again. And, you know, in my, what was I, 5 and a half, maybe 6? I made that decision and I stuck to it for about 4 decades. And what I became, what I had to become, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody how I'm feeling and what's going on, so I had to become a really awesome mind reader and do a whole lot of telepathy and stuff, you know? So, and of course, none of that really worked, but it did get me in tune. I became highly, highly sensitive to how other people were feeling around me. You can't really hide feelings. Not from kids, anyway. And so when my dad would come home in a rage, which sometimes he did, I would know, I could kind of sense the climate coming, like the winter is coming, and I'd better go get a blanket, go somewhere and be warm. Like, just had to get away. And it, you know, if there was humor, that was cool, I could come out for something like that, but anything else that sort of was seemed threatening, I would just begin to isolate more and more and more as a child. And one of the results that happened to me, well, it's actually something my mom did a lot of too, you know. She's very deeply sensitive and artistic and type person, you know, she's a very beautiful woman. And she had a way of really putting on a shine out in public. Like, people really glommed on her. People loved her. And but at home, she just would, you know, kind of pack up her bags and go upstairs into her room, close the door, and listen to Bob Dylan. And for years and years and years, I couldn't stand Bob Dylan. And I didn't know why. I was just like, "Bob Dylan, he sucks. He's not a very good artist, you know that?" And, you know, my mom was somewhat obsessed with him, and I realized later, as I was doing more recovery work, why? It's because, you know, Bob Dylan was taking my place and taking up my time with my mom. And I didn't like that. So, you know, here I was isolating, here she was isolating, and everybody else was just trying to get along without fighting and screaming and yelling. And one day my mom just calls out of the blue, "Eric, come on up to the room." And it's not like I came up into her room very often, because that was sort of a, you know, no-fly zone. You don't get to go there. And anyway, she called me up special, and she says, "Eric, I need to see you right away." So I came up, and, you know, I was nervous because, well, I had mixed emotions about it. On the one hand, I really wanted my mother's attention and love, so I wanted to go. And on the other hand, I was really afraid of getting my mother's attention and love because it was a little weird. It was branded strange. And, you know, so I get up into her room, and she says, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah." "Are you sure?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine." "Why? What's going on?" She goes, "I just had a dream about you. Your hair was on fire, and I couldn't put it out. Are you sure you're okay?" And I had this feeling deep in my pit that just really, like, turned the wrong way. I don't know why that bothered me so much. Until years later, when I took a real close look at why I might have felt that way. And what it boils down to is, here I was being asked by my mother to essentially calm her down. And I'm the child. It's kind of reversed. And so, you know, some people call that, you know, emotional incest. And it felt like really strange. It felt really good in a way because, wow, look what I'm being trusted with. But then it was like, wow, look what I'm being asked to do. This is pretty intense. You know, and so so that just sort of like pushed me more into not really wanting to interact that much with her, just more afraid of her, more afraid of women. Eventually what would happen in our family is my parents' relationship would just crumble, fall apart, and my mom would leave the home. Something that she had been threatening to do all my childhood. So it wasn't entirely a surprise, but when it happened, it was a major shock to our family system. And I realized the fear I'd always had, which was, you know, the fear of being abandoned by a parent. And, you know, as I've been going through my four-step work, and it deeply affected me as a child. And it still has affected me today. I'm not entirely free from that, clearly. But one of the things that I've learned to do is to shift how I think about what my mom did. And I used to say, "Oh yeah, my mom abandoned me. I'm an abandoned child. That's the only way I saw it." And my sponsor helped me to realize that I could shift that a little by saying simply that my mother left. Because she did that too. And I realized, you know, there wasn't really an abandonment. There was just a parent who wasn't available, who finally became permanently unavailable. And so, you know, my dad's reaction to my mother leaving, you know, she was kind of like everything to him. I can see that now, you know, having been married myself and knowing what it's like to love someone so much that they become everything for you. I didn't know that as a child, but I could see how my dad felt that way about my mom. And when she left him, it was like his God left him. And so, you know, his reactions to that are a lot like the ones I've heard of a lot of Al-Anons that are untreated. And just a lot of anger, a lot of rage, a lot of, you know, he had no problems like... he had so much rage, actually, coming home each night that he would lay hands on just about every single one of us that he could. And there's a lot of us. That's a lot of rage. And, you know, I would live like that with my father for about 4 years, where every day was like that. And some of the other things, you know, began to occur, you know, during that time, you know, was... my dad would say things to me like, "You know, you kids are the reason mom left." And I'd be like, "What did we do?" And he would say things like, "You didn't clean the house fast enough or good enough. And then she couldn't hack living here anymore. And that's your fault." And as a kid, I didn't know any better. I didn't know, for instance, that as an Al-Anon in my illness, I love to take responsibility for things that are really not my fault at all. Because, you know, if I can turn something that I'm completely powerless over into something that I did wrong, that gives me something I can do. And as an Al-Anon, my disease tells me there's got to be something I can do about everything, even the things I'm powerless over. And so, you know, my dad also kind of, he had this idea. I don't know where he probably got that from, the home he was growing up in, being made to feel like he was somehow maybe responsible for maintaining his mom and their parent when his parents broke up. And he told me, you know, Eric, you know, he kind of stroked me some and said, you're special, you know, you're that one guy in this family that really shines bright. So you're going to have to be just responsible for kind of bringing back all your wayward brothers and sisters. And for a long time, I was just like, yeah, like a badge, you know, I'm going to be the super, you know, hero, going to save this family, going to make this thing work. And all it did was just sort of feed that sense of over-responsibility that I had kind of been doing, you know, up to that point. It's just take it further, you know. And, you know, during that period, with all the violence that was in the home and all this, you know, craziness, it was a period where I just sort of... I just acted out in any kind of juvenile kind of delinquent way I could find. And that included doing things like breaking into other people's homes and stealing friends' money and, you know, breaking into local businesses and stealing their produce, breaking into people's cars, leaving feces places that should never be found, egging cars and buses. I got real good at the buses one. And just... generally roaming the streets real late at night with nothing good to do. I did that during that 3 or 4 year period. And a couple of things kind of helped turn things around for me in that period. And I played some football for a city league, and that kind of got me out of the house, out of that, in, you know, the insanity for a while. Ended up winning a trophy for most improved player. I remember I had a major resentment over that. It's like, most valuable player, that's the one I want, right? You need me, right? Not most improved, that just sounds stupid. And it didn't matter that a member of parliament actually signed a letter and gave that to me. Didn't matter. And, you know, but playing football, you know, kind of helped my self-esteem some. I didn't feel like just a big piece of crap. And it got me out to socialize some more and get to, you know, just get out of that isolation that I was in. My dad, you know, remarried my mom's best friend. That's just how Al-Anons work. And, you know, it's a small, tight circle, right? And then we moved into a new home. So it was sort of like a fresh start. And one of the new things that my family started to do was to take us to church regularly. I'm really glad that my father did that. Because again, it was another outlet for me to go around, be around other people that were of goodwill, decent people. And, you know, and so my life, that church sort of experience started to help my life expand a little bit. They had plays I got to kind of perform in, to sort of discover myself a little bit there, feeling a little less lonely, you know. And, so it was really hard to sort of make friends, you know, outside that church circuit, you know, because I'd isolated so long, I didn't really develop my social skills much. It seemed easier within the church circle. That was seemed safer. So, you know, and being in that environment helped me to discover that I was, I had this affinity for things of a spiritual nature. And I found that that was something I might actually be good at. And so, you know, I flipped from being the juvenile to becoming compulsively good, if you know what I mean by that. Like, you're not doing good. I wasn't doing good because it was good. That's what you should do. I was being good because the girls at church were hot. And I was like, you get the girls at church by being really good. That's how you get them. And, you know, my dad reinforced that idea by coming to me one time and saying, you know, if you do this and you do this and that, you know, all these commandments and stuff, you know, hard to live by commandments, you can have any girl you want. And I was like, yeah, that's how good I'm going to be. I'm going to get any girl I want. That's the drug of choice for an Al-Anon like me. And so so I sort of went into that phase where it really just sort of, but all it really did was the side of me that was judgmental and super self-righteous just got stroked bigger and bigger and bigger during those times. And I became kind of I could have fun or whatever, but don't get me in a corner with you alone. You might not have a fun conversation with Eric. I'll be telling you what you're doing wrong, or I'll be telling you why you're wrong and why I'm right, and all of that. And so, of course, dating was just a really uncomfortable experience in high school. I didn't know what I was doing, but I just figured I should just know how to date without ever being told how you do it. I'll just figure this one out on my own. That strategy didn't work so good. Because essentially I was dealing with fears that were way more powerful than any, you know, self-will I might be able to muster. You know, I was afraid of rejection, number one. I was afraid, you know, things aren't going to work out. This whole mother situation is just going to keep repeating itself. And so I dated thinking, okay, well, I'm going to control this stuff. I'm going to make it work. And what happened? All the girls left me. I didn't leave them. And, you know, I really only had a couple of criteria for dating. She had to be cute and she had to like me. That was it. Pretty simple. And the second rule was once attached, never let go. Right? And so, you know, what did that do? It just made a lot of girls angry and not like me and leave me. And so, you know, there had been a lot done for me by those people at the church. And so I felt the need to take 2 years of my life and dedicate it to sort of community service in their honor. And when I got back from doing that, and that was a very growing experience, very scary experience for a guy like me, because I'm afraid of everybody. I'm supposed to go out and talk to them. Man, they don't know who I am. But I came back from that. You know, the real reason I went, again, was you do the good things, you get the hot girls. That's why I did those 2 years. And so I came back and I ended up falling in love with her. You know what the her means if you're a guy. You know, the one. You know what I mean, right? You Al-Anon girls want to be the one, right? In my case, she was beautiful and she liked me. And she asked me to marry her in the first 2 weeks. So clearly, she needed me. So I moved to Toronto, 5 hours away, and we got married 5 months later. That's how this Al-Anon rolls. Thank you very much. Okay. And, you know, during that first time, the first, like, year or two, she just cried every single night. And, but of course, she was crying on my shoulder. And I loved that. But the trick of that was every time she cried, I kind of felt responsible for why she was crying. Even though I'm nursing her back, you know. It's kind of a twisted kind of a connection. You know, oh, I've hurt you, but let me fix you. And the reality is, you know, she was just a deeply emotional person that had problems and came into the marriage that way. And just like I did. We were sort of two half people trying to become one whole. And I once heard it said in a meeting, in our 7 o'clock What's Rock meeting, that two halves don't make a whole. Two halves, you know, turn into a cycle whirlwind and take everybody out. you know, if she had troubles, I was more than eager to step in and try and help and fix stuff for her and help her. And I thought that was love. And I thought it was my duty as a husband. And, you know, if she needed anything, I made sure that she got it and I went without. That was another duty I just felt. I don't know where I got that from. Maybe my dad. And so there we are, young and married. I get into university. That's a big, you know, switch for me. I started to feel really good because I managed to get into a pretty decent university and where I wanted to study and develop myself. And as I was in university, you know, I started to realize, you know, that the 4 or 5 years that I spent there nourished this very Al-Anonic idea of mine, that perhaps my problem is a lack of knowledge. And if I just get the right kind of knowledge, my problem will go away. And so you know what I did? Read every book I could get, watched every documentary I could find. I made sure I didn't leave any sort of knowledge area unturned. I thought that's where the solution was. And, you know, when I got into university, I wanted to be a doctor, like a physiotherapist. That's such an Al-Anon type of, you know, a job, you know, where you're helping fix people. But I switched gears and went into psychology instead. Why? Well, because I wanted to know more about how people break and how you go about fixing them. And I thought they knew. And they do actually have a lot of ideas towards that very end goal. And not to say that they aren't successful in some ways. They certainly are. There's a place for it. But for me, I never wanted to ever admit that I needed to go further than a book or the internet. I didn't want to connect with another person to ever ask for help. And so if knowledge was my problem, well, I could get to knowledge without going through people. And so I figured, okay, I spent a lot of time doing that. And, you know, during that same time, joined a band. That was fun. Started to learn how to, you know, play guitar some, write some music. And my former wife, you know, at the time, she was really encouraging of me in that way. She loved to sing to the songs I was writing and all that. And that was a very nice thing that we had. We started to see some success. Some of our music was being played on Much Music. And you're like, what? What is Much Music? And you're like, it's just Much Music. No, it's sort of Canada's MTV. And so it was getting played on that, and we started to play along some of the bigger music festivals. And so that became something she and I started to do quite a bit of together. And that was also good. But during those periods, you know, basically, our marriage was always rocky. And we had already separated, I think, twice by the time we were married, about 7 years. And on the second, you know, separation, I was being labeled by her as a sinking ship. And so clearly, all the relationship problems got to be my fault if I'm the sinking ship. Again, I'm feeling like it's all, you know, I'm taking all the responsibility for a relationship there. You know, and I never questioned that. I just assumed that that's how it is. And so, didn't take long. I graduate school. We decide music in Canada sucks, which it does. And it's time to move to LA because music here doesn't suck. That's right. And so we do our, you know, 5,000 mile trek to the Great West. And we get here, spend maybe 5 more years, you know, just doing more music and getting out there and just trying to get along, you know. Me the whole time, I'm not really telling her what I need. She's just complaining most of the time, and I'm doing the best I can to keep her as happy as I can so she won't leave. And we kept that up for about another 5 years, and then finally she took probably the most successful opportunity that we had in our music career and just tanked it in order to go solo, something she'd always wanted to do. And, you know, that was devastating to me at the time. But, you know, I told her when just before we were married that I would do everything in my power to help her in her artistic endeavors, whatever it be. So I lived up to that. I actually created my own resentment in that regard. I could see that now. So when that sort of breach of our relationship happened at that level, you know, it was a ticking time bomb, our marriage. And so we were at therapists, and the therapist, you know, was suggesting to me, hey, Eric, you should probably go to Al-Anon. I'm like, I don't even know what Al-Anon is, man. She's like, well, do you know what AA is? And I'm like, yeah, I've heard of AA. What's Al-Anon? She says, well, AA is for the alcoholics so they can get sober and have recovery. And Al-Anon is for the rest of the family. And I was just perplexed because my wife and I never drank. So I couldn't see how Al-Anon was a place for me. But, you know, my wife was like threatening to leave. And so I'm a eager people pleaser. So off I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And, you know, I don't even remember when that was because what's the point in knowing when it happened if I'm not really intending on coming back or staying for any length of time? This is just going to be one of those things I'm just going to try and forget that I had to do. And nobody wants to admit that they need help in a basement, in a church on a Friday night when they should be out having fun. And, you know, I was clearly one of those guys. And what happened was my eagerness to try and show her how good I am, just like I was when I was a kid. I just translated that to Al-Anon, so I got a sponsor right away. I bought all the literature. I went to tons of meetings, all to show off. That's what I was doing. Look at me. Can't leave me now, can you? And what ended up happening instead was I started to see some of the benefits of the program, even though I wasn't really fully, you know, into it. And she started to get more and more distant from me, not closer. And I remember going to my sponsor at the time and asking him, like, what's up with that? Like, she's been telling me and giving me ultimatums, and then when I live up to them, she says, yeah, adios, I'm out of here. What's up with that? I thought it's supposed to be the other way around. And what he said to me was, well, you know, some people's relationships that were forged in the disease don't have what it takes to withstand recovery. And it shocked me because I had never thought of her in any openly critical way before. I never really thought of, like, she might be sick. Because I had taken all that responsibility on myself. And so I started to open up and you know, it didn't take long. You know, the marriage obviously didn't work out. And, you know, she told me she didn't want to be married anymore. That's a good reason probably not to stay married. and so I was sort of forced. At that point, I had so little people around that I knew. So few of my friends were still around. So few of the people around. My life had become so small that the only real people in my life that I could turn to that I felt I could really open up to were people in Al-Anon. And so something happened. I just sort of shifted and started coming because I needed to come. And what happened was, you know, Al-Anon's like had a major impact on my life. They say in Al-Anon, you know, if you want to feel better, just get to a meeting. If you want to be better, work the steps with a sponsor, and if you want to do better, be a service. That's how this program works. You just do all those three things. And for me, you know, getting to meetings, well, that's not hard, you know. Like, I remember somebody in a meeting once giving me this great analogy, and they said, you know, hey, Eric, your head is like this a bad liver that needs dialysis. And if you go too long without going to a meeting, your dialysis for your head, you're going to get stinking thinking. It's going to go bad on you. And so I started like tracking like just how sick I was getting between meetings because I didn't want to go to too many. So I was like, okay, you know, like, is one enough? Is one enough? No, I'm going crazy. two enough? No. And it balanced out to about three or four a week. That's what I need, even now. You know? And because if I stay away from you long enough, what comes back is the disease. And it comes back with a vengeance. It wants me dead. It ain't playing games, like, and you know, so that's all there is to really, you know, get into meetings. It's not that hard, you know, get to enough of them. That's key number one. And number two, you know, to doing the steps, well, try doing them with a sponsor. That's probably a good idea. And how about doing them with a sponsor that has one? Like a sponsor, I mean. Oh, and how about your sponsor actually has worked the steps before you? That's a good idea too. And you know, I say that, and I'm kind of a little bit joking around that, but the reality is, you know, like, I came into Al-Anon and I spent 4.5 or 5 years just switching sponsors because I just couldn't pick one that seemed to work for me. I don't have a good picker, so how am I supposed to pick a good sponsor? Right? And of course, the answer is, duh, your higher power leads you to one. I'm like, oh. And that did happen for me. And the cool thing about having the 4 or 5 different sponsors before you land the one, you get a lot of good practice working step in 1, 2, and 3. And you can start to sound really good at 1, 2, and 3 that people want you to sponsor them. That's my story. And what happened to me is, you know, I hit that 4th step and I just stopped cold. And it was like, you know, I tried to do it in several different ways. It just, I couldn't do it. I was scared essentially that what I would learn is that I'm a lost cause. That if I looked at this stuff honestly, I just have to go out into some field in some melodramatic way and end it all. Like, because I'm a lost cause. And I just figured denial was better than being a lost cause. And so for several years, what I did was found all kinds of ways to distract myself from doing my 4th step. I thought 2.5 or 3 years of grief work, that sounds like a good idea. Let's just do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds easier than doing my 4th step. Let's do that. But I finally completed my 4th step last year. That was a major thing for me. And you know how I got it done? I had a sponsee come up behind me in his step work and surpassed me in the 4th step. And my pride just could not handle that. And I thank that sponsee for like pushing my disease right up into the gear it needed to in order for me to get through that 4th step. And you know, the end result was surprisingly underwhelming. That was the biggest surprise for me in Al-Anon, is that when I'm done my 4th step, I'm like, is that it? Really? I think you'll find if you're scared to death of your 4th step, just do it anyway. And let us hold your hand while you do it, whatever it takes. Because most of the people that I know end their 4th step feeling a major shift inside of themselves, and certainly a shift that I felt. And it's that I'm no longer a victim anymore. I can see my part in everything. And the other benefit that comes from doing your 4th step is now that you've taken your own inventory, if you're afraid of other people's criticism, hey, now you got something to compare it to. See if they're full of it or where they might actually be right. Because before doing a 4th step, I didn't know. You could have said anything and I would have taken responsibility for it. Yeah, I guess I am. You're a lying sack. Well, in some ways I was, but. And in step 5, you know, which is where I'm at now, That's the uncovering, discovering, and discarding process begins there. And a lot of the things that were uncovered and are being uncovered for me is just a lot of the feelings that I stuffed as a child and stuffed all through my life. A lot of those are coming back, you know. I'm finding it's okay to feel. Because feelings don't last forever, thank goodness. You know. But they're valuable information about me that helps me know who I am. And, you know, there's been a lot of things I've learned about myself as a result of paying attention to how I feel about things. So if you're new to Al-Anon, I want to thank you for coming. You're some of the most important people in this meeting tonight. We don't have a program without you. And for those of you who've been coming, long-timers, we also don't have a program without you. Thank you. But I want to put a special welcome to any of you who might be feeling like you're in your last 30 days of Al-Anon. Just know that there's plenty of us in here that have felt the same way and worked our way past that. And we can help. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Thanks.